We're going to begin now, and we'd like to begin by sanctifying our space and ourselves and our time together. And we do that by making the sound of Om in unison. Let's take three deep breaths. And with a deep in breath. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Of course, we can't sanctify this space. It's already sanctified, and so are we. But we can bring our attention to it, can't we? Isn't that a beautiful diagram to introduce our subject for the day, which is your highest self? And these teachings come from the Bhagavad Gita, which translated is the song of the Lord. Song of the Lord. We will look at some scripture, and then we'll look at a commentary by Sri Swami Satchidananda. Very beautiful commentary. So we're going to jump right in and look at three, they're called sutras or verses, and see how they might apply to us. With a self-disciplined mind, you experience a state of constant serenity. Anyone experience a state of constant serenity these days?
Of course.
The path towards a state of constant serenity is to discipline the mind. To discipline the mind, the first step is to notice that you have a mind. We talk about it as an intellectual concept, but until we actually experience that we have a mind, our mind is not who we are. It's something we have, like a fingernail or hair or an arm and a mind. And we can observe our fingernails, and we can observe our mind. And if we learn to observe our mind, that's the first step in a self-disciplined mind, just to observe it. Once you begin observing your mind, you might notice that your mind not only isn't you, but has a mind of its own, and just seems to think thoughts willy-nilly that you may or may not choose to think. And then your mind may even start to think thoughts that you wish you weren't thinking and decide you don't want to think, but it continues thinking them anyway. Like, I'm not going to think about that latest outrage. Oh, it was really bad. Your mind just goes on thinking about it, doesn't it? Today, we're not going to look at how to discipline the mind. And we may know that the practice of meditation is very helpful in disciplining the mind. A steady, regular practice of meditation. Now, we can talk about meditation techniques here if anyone wishes. It's good to review those things. So I'm happy to do that. All right, with a self-disciplined mind, you experience a state of constant serenity. Well, that sounds like a worthwhile thing, doesn't it? To have a self-disciplined mind. And correctly identifying with your highest self, which is called Atman in Sanskrit, your highest self. Your highest self can't really be described as something that you might look for to experience within you, your highest self. We'll talk about that some more. With a self-disciplined mind, you experience a state of constant serenity, correctly identifying with your highest self, Atman, who remains unaffected in heat or cold. And we don't remain unaffected, but the highest self remains unaffected in pleasure or pain. When we experience pain, we get upset. We experience pleasure, sometimes we're joyful. There is a part of us called the highest self that is unaffected in pleasure or pain. Just as I've described how we might experience our mind, can we experience that highest self within us? And what are the steps to do that? The first step is to think that there might be that highest self within me. It's called the Christ consciousness in the unity tradition. So just to allow that concept to exist then might open the possibility so that when we experience our highest self, maybe not all the time, we say, ah, that's my highest self I'm experiencing. Okay. Just to give it a name. Although sometimes names get in the way, don't they? Sometimes names get in the way, but for now, since we're human beings of language, let's admit there's a highest self and let's open ourselves to experiencing it, who remains unaffected in heat or cold, pleasure or pain, remains unaffected by praise or blame. It's one thing to free yourself from being reactivated by blame. You're wrong. Did that wrong. You're a wrong person. It's one thing to remain unaffected by blame. And the way to head in that direction is to be unaffected by praise. Unaffected by praise. You can learn to be unaffected by praise. It's the path to free ourselves from blame. Yes.
I was just going to say, I find it so interesting. I've never understood those to be two sides of the same coin before. But, you know, I just didn't understand that. I completely agree. And I see where they're connected. And I can see I really, for myself, likening it to myself, I really hate blame. I can feel it coming, and you know, but at the same time, I had a professor point out to me recently that I really like praise. Like, there's a validation aspect. Yeah. Well, I go to school for psychology, so when he said that, I was like, I could tell that it was true. I was like, man, you're a genius. You know what I mean? Like, he was just working his talents on me. So, so it's interesting. I just now put them together. Yeah.
Identifying with praise occurs when we identify the self as self. When we identify ourself as our ego or intellect, so on, so. A practice that you can use to help free yourself first from praise, then blame is to notice that the benefit when someone praises you is not yours. The benefit is the person giving the praise. They're the one who get the benefit. You are the disinterested observer, noticing how the person praising you raises himself and expands herself and heads towards his or her highest self. In the same way that when someone blames you, or you see someone blaming someone else, they are watering the lower seeds in themselves, the negative seeds in themselves, and not benefiting themselves. So you can, when you see the blame coming out, feel compassion for that person because they have done a bit of harm to themselves by watering those seeds of blame. So the harm comes to them, not you. Now, this doesn't mean we don't perhaps respond positively to praise or get upset when we're blamed, because it's a human reaction. Can we, after we have those experiences, step back in the next moment, or maybe the next morning when our mind starts to go over it, you know, the blame, can we then step back and look to see how that blame or praise has something to do with the person that gave it, and not take it personally? Don't take it personally in a way it had nothing to do with you. You see, that person who offered the praise or the blame is in a movie theater of life. It's the movie theater of life. Big cinema screen, and you're one of the actors in it. And he sees or she sees you in a particular way. And if she thinks you're really a praise, in the movie could praise or could blame. But you exist in the cinema next door, and your movie theater of life is totally different. You see things totally different. You see him differently than he sees himself. So you can, in your movie theater of life, not take things personally. Just notice that the benefit or the not benefit exists in the person. And that's how you begin to have a self-disciplined mind and experience a state of constant security, serenity, correctly identifying with your highest self, Atman, who remains unaffected in heat or cold, pleasure or pain, praise or blame.
Thank you so much for this. When I hear this exercise and allow everybody else to experience or share, it meets my needs for community and self-awareness. I want just to share that.
Thank you, Sam. Any other reactions? Yes,
sir. Yeah, I'm thinking of this praise and blame thing, and that's how we teach children. I mean, that's how children learn. And I think that when we've got praise or blame, we could take the opportunity to look at, first of all, is there anything in there for me before you rise above it and give it back to the person who gave it to you?
Yes, there's two sides in the praise-blame game. My wife broke her hip, so she's in physical therapy now. We went to physical therapy last Thursday. We'll go again tomorrow. And during the physical therapy, she's in some discomfort. It hurts a lot. The physical therapist, as she does things, will say, "Good girl, that well done. Good, I'm proud of you. Do it again." She never says, "Oh, you screwed that one up. You're not doing that well enough. Why can't you raise your leg a little higher?" No. It's constant praise. It's constant praise. We can't expect everyone in the world to be in the state of spiritual progress that we are in, can we? So, although we may be teaching ourselves to step back from praise and blame, that doesn't mean that we don't hand out praise with a spirit of generosity. Spirit of generosity.
I grew up with praise much of my life, and to undo that is so difficult. However, with the practice of NBC and the feelings and needs and language, there's a way for me to praise. So rather than saying, "Steve, you're wonderful, you're brilliant," right? There's a superlative.
I am.
Right. Of course. I might say, so when you shared your thought and example, I felt deeply lighter because it allowed me to laugh. and allow me to self-connect within myself. And that was so meaningful and uplifting. Thank you.
Right. Mm-hmm. So these practices are heading in one direction, self-disciplined mind, and to get the benefits. Let's go on. I got a feeling we're not going to get as far as I thought.
We never do.
But it's more meaningful and richer when we share.
A true and steady yogi. What is a yogi in this context? A yogi is an evolved spiritual person. We are all yogis at different steps on our spiritual path. But a true and steady yogi we can consider as someone who's gone quite far along the spiritual path and still has a ways to go, just like us. So we are yogis. A true and steady yogi is utterly content with the wisdom of real knowing. We've just been discussing real knowing. Do you see that? Real knowing, being able to step back from our own minds, is real knowing. A true and steady yogi is utterly content with the wisdom of real knowing, is not disturbed by anything. We have to look at this very carefully, because we know as human beings we get disturbed and we get blamed when bad things happen, when there's just something upset, we get disturbed. So we can look at this as not disturbed means noticing that our highest self is not disturbed. And just because our mind gets disturbed and we have disturbing emotions and they head down into our throats and our arms and our shoulders and our eyes and tears and whatever, still our highest self is not disturbed by anything. And the more that we come into experiencing our higher self, the easier it is for us to permit ourselves to be upset in our head and our tears and whatever, and to permit that watching it and observing it. Our core is never upset, even though our physical body, our senses, and so on may experience disruptions. Knowing that we are that highest self, we may not be able to step back in the moment, but maybe afterwards or the next morning, step back and say, that's just my body, my mind having an upset, reaching down and making a mess of me physically. But my highest self remained undisturbed by anything. That's the practice. Has controlled and calmed the senses. At some point, as we're more in touch with our higher self, according to the scriptures and according to the testimony of people who have achieved these higher states, we can actually control and calm our senses so that they don't run out of control reactively. We get blamed, we reactivate. As we progress on our spiritual path, we find that we get less reactivated, a little bit less, until at some point we've more control and more calmed the senses. And we can then look with equal vision on a dirt clod, a stone, or a nugget of gold. All just equal creations. Equal vision. I've got a gold ring on here. I don't consider that the same as a dirt clod. The dirt clod I can throw away. I don't want to lose my gold ring. Isn't that interesting? I have an attachment to my gold ring here. And what if I were losing or lost my gold ring? Would I be disturbed by that? Would my senses be remain calm and controlled? Depends where I am on my spiritual path. Actually, I don't own this ring. It's not mine. It belongs to God. I'm a temporary custodian of this ring. If this ring isn't on my finger and I don't know where it is, God's still got it somewhere. Wherever she's got it, well, that's okay. It's still fine wherever it is.
It's so hard to do when we start a sentence with my, or my car, my stuff, my bank account, my
dirt clod.
Dirt clod.
This is my dirt clod.
Stay away from my dirt clod.
Don't touch my stone.
So is it one way is to perhaps look at disowning things and saying the object as opposed to my object? So if I go into my cleaners and say, would you be willing to clean this spot instead of saying my shirt on this spot? You see what I'm saying? I've been thinking about that for a while. So if I change my language instead of saying a possessive like mine.
I think that's a good spiritual practice for you, Sam.
Interesting.
It's a good spiritual practice for you. It may work for others, it may not. But for you, it sounds like a good spiritual practice to help free you from the tyranny of I, my, mine,
right.
Mine, so that we can have things without possessing them. There's a distinction. Have things without possessing. Having means the universe is arranged for things to be near me and I have to take care of things, and the universe takes them back when the universe is ready. I'm not really in control. It seems like I am, but I'm not. I just have it, but I don't possess it. It's in possession of the universe and of God. When we have practices like that, it helps us to step back from the I, me, mine, which is part of our ego. And that ego business is useful and can be very useful. It's certainly helpful in communication. You know, this is my ring and that's your ring. It just helps us communicate with each other. The challenge is, can we step back and realize nothing is mine? I was brought into this world with what?
Right.
When I leave this world, what will I take with me? You're not taking your body with you. That goes back as fertilizer into the earth.
The dirt clod.
The dirt clod. So while we're here, we're made temporary custodian of things. That's how the world works. Yeah. Now, different societies have different notions of this temporary custodianship. In our society, if you have a spouse, for example, one of the rules of spousehood is you're not supposed to share the spouse around. And if people do share themselves around, it can have consequences that may bring on disturbances of the senses. There are societies where spouses are shared.
Well, if we are to practice non-attachment, then it should apply to that, shouldn't it?
Non-attachment, yes. Yes, it can be tricky. We have to look at the well-being of everyone. So if one is choosing to be non-spousal in one's conduct, is that something that is a kind and loving thing to do to everyone concerned?
There's other
considerations.
Free will is a thing too in this life. Yes, we don't come in with anything. I accept that, and I'm not defending running free and like whatever.
No,
I'm just playing
no.
the devil's advocate.
If you want to play into the idea of free will, we do have free will in this life. That is part of the process of going through this incarnation and experiencing the world. You know, certain lessons that we're here to learn through our free will. So at least that's my belief. But I also think that we have known about the fact that certain things are trickier, so we've put in certain things in place so that, because I mean, in most societies it is not looked upon very kindly if you share family members with each other, you know, like, I think I like your husband better, and you know, like, no, you don't. Most people don't like that, and that is also part of the process of, yeah, this is going to disturb me.
Yeah.
So, should we apply to the same thing?
Yeah. So, I would just propose again the feeling of need. So, there is a compassionate component to the four-step model, and then there's honesty. We need both, right? So, for me, I'm a monogamous person, and I'm not in a relationship, and I don't want to be in a relationship now at this moment in my stage of my life. But the sharing the truth of what I need is how the other person can understand where I'm coming from. And so from that point of view, then now we can be clear and transparent. Right? And I think if we speak from the feelings and needs perspective, then we can share compassionately, listen compassionately, and also share authentic truth with respectful communication.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. I'll just point out one thing because we got a little off track here.
Yeah, sure.
Just one thing that I've sex. Sex always gets us going. I read about a community, I believe it's in Tibet, where a woman has multiple husbands. That's perfectly fine, everybody's perfectly at ease with it, and it's an economical thing came about, or survival. And of course we know in other areas, the Mormons, for example, used to practice polygamy, where one man had multiple wives, and it's still practiced in some countries to some extent, and the women and men seem perfectly okay with it. It's the way.
I think we're
so there are different models of having and possessing. Just to open ourselves up that our model of having and possessing is great for us, and there may be other models that are just as loving, kind, and okay. Really important. Because how can we loosen ourselves up from this idea of having, this is mine? Little things to help us loosen our grip on this is mine, this is not yours.
Very interesting. It's being able to understand our own internal and how we're raised with regards to our moral values, and yet not imposing that upon somebody else or somebody else's culture. And having that deep perspective, each culture and each upbringing has different perspectives.
Yes, it's good if we can do that, and we notice that many people don't.
Yeah.
Feel like it's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
And we have compassion for them as well, because each of us is at a different place on our spiritual path.
What if your true self, or your, like, what if where you are in your spiritual path directly coincides with the environment that you're in? So what if you're in modern day America and you decide that you want to be polygamous, and or that's where you are in your spiritual path, or whatever the kids call it right now, like open relation, I don't know, it's a thing that's going on. Like, what if it's completely different, and where your spiritual path is, it's living within the boundaries and guidelines of what other people say. And so that's what you're tasked with. Being content, but also being true to your highest self. and where you want to be spiritual.
I certainly don't have answers to all these questions and all these scenarios. Can we, as our spiritual practice, notice that we have these questions and see these different ways of holding things, and step back from it and notice that's a particular way we're holding it. Notice that others hold it the same and others hold it as different. Step back from that as well. Notice that society holds certain behaviors certain way, and there are penalties and policemen and courts and judges and so on for particular kinds of behavior, and step back from that as well and say, ah, that's how things are. And breathe into it and not be disturbed by it and notice it. And can we develop this further practice? Instead of operating out of the ego mind and making decisions from the ego mind, which I have done a lot, and sometimes that's a useful thing to do, can we, when the situation calls for it, let go of the ego mind and wait until our heart guides us? Have the patience, not in all things. When I'm doing computer work, my mind is very helpful. I do everything it tells me. But when I write poetry, my mind isn't very useful. I have to wait and see what my heart tells me, and then I write down what it tells me. Can we recognize that we have an ego mind and an intellect? It's very useful. We also have a heart, and a heart knowledge that in many ways is superior to our intellectual knowledge. Can we honor that and respect it and have the patience when our mind is confused and doesn't know this way, what should I do? Okay. This is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, and you're in a state of confusion. Can we have the patience to step back from our own mind, situations like that, and wait for guidance from our heart and be patient? And have had the experience of waiting for heart guidance, then know that it works. And once you have that experience, then you're more willing to be patient and wait for it. Especially if you made some intellectual decisions, some major ones that didn't work out very well. Some life decisions, you just figured out, well, here's the good points and the bad points, and the good points and the bad points. And that's how you made the decision when there is a part of you in your heart that said, no, hold on, but you didn't pay attention. So having that discernment, knowing when to use the head intelligence, knowing when to have the patience to wait for the heart intelligence. Because when the heart intelligence guides you, somehow you're perfectly at ease. You're not disturbed by anything. That highest intelligence that's talking to you. They're not, you've controlled and calmed the senses in a way. You're listening here. You look at dirt and gold with equal vision from that heart consciousness. Just things. When you come from your heart consciousness, you're utterly content with the wisdom of real knowing, because that's the source of real knowing. Yes, intellectual knowing is useful, but in the things that count, the real knowing comes from the heart. Everyone see that?
Real knowing comes from
the heart. From the heart.
Did you say that or see that?
Do I say it or see it?
I'm sorry. I heard something else when I started.
Yeah. Real knowing comes from the highest self, which we all call the heart of Christ consciousness. Well, let's do one more slook and then we'll finish up. Won't do any commentary whatsoever. A person stands supreme who has equal regard for friends, companions, equal regard, enemies. Equal regard. Neutral arbiters. equal regard for hateful people. Anyone know a hateful person? Or maybe don't know the person, but you've seen them on TV. Social media, read about it. And
I know what you're talking about.
Good for you. A person stands supreme who has equal regard for hateful people, relatives, saints, and sinners. Equal regard. Now, how can you have equal regard? This will get into the commentary, which we'll do next time, but I'm going to give you a little hint. Think about your friend and think about a hateful person. Can you think of one thing that the hateful person and the friend have in common? Something we've talked about today. What do they have in common?
One's cold and one's a dirt clot.
Pardon? Both
of
them using their egos.
Oh, both of the egos, yeah, that's sort of a human characteristic. What else does a hateful person and a friend have in common that we've been discussing a few minutes ago? We gave it a name. We called it the highest self.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
We were just talking about that. Your friend and the hateful person both have a high self. Both have it. When Mother Teresa looked at a person, she said, "I only see Christ." Mother Teresa said that. She gave her testimony. When I look at another person, she looked at friends. She had plenty of enemies. I guess since she dealt with hateful people, she said, "I see Christ." We've called that the highest self. So that's the spiritual practice to free us from the tyranny of moral judgments on people. Not that we don't have them, not suggesting we take away our moral judgments, but along with our moral judgment, can we also see that that individual, whether they're a saint or a sinner, has a high self. Came into the world with it, leave the world with it. Some people say it was there before they came, still hangs around after the body goes away. Highest self. See how that helps free you from the tyranny and the weight of moral judgments and blaming and praising. Just makes you a tad lighter. You're still blaming, you're still praising, but maybe you're just a little lighter weight, a little calmer. Noticing that all those people have a highest self. See that? So that when your mind goes into blame, they're wrong, praise, oh, thank God for them, you can step back and see that those people have a highest self. Now, they also have minds and egos, and in their minds and egos, they may be watering the seeds of blame and disruption and fear and anger, or they may be watering the seeds of kindness and beneficence in their mind and ego. But that's just their mind. We all have minds. In addition, we have a high self. So by noticing, switching our attention from the blame and the praise, especially in this political season, we've got another year of it, switching our attention just a little bit from who's right and who's wrong to the highest self, every individual, helps us be more the person we were brought here to be, which is perfectly at ease, and perfectly content. That's who we were brought here to be. And we have to learn some spiritual practices because we're not always perfectly content. So by making little baby steps here and there, we're happy. We need to close now. Any other questions or comments before we close?
Thank you, Steve.
So again, we don't sanctify ourselves with the room, but we notice the sanctity in ourselves and in the room and in the time we spend together by making a sound of Om together. Let's take three conscious deep breaths. And the deep in breath. Shanti, shanti, shanti.
Thank you.